Okay, thank you. So, as Gary said, I'm going to talk about Gini net conversions from a very simple low-order model, where it's low-order coupled to a turbulent shell model. I'll explain that in a second. And I should say this is work with a student, David Ryan, who has been at this program, but unfortunately had to be back in Newcastle this week, so isn't here this week, but many of you met him in the last few weeks. Okay, so as Peter Olsen said an hour or so ago, next time we all meet together here in KITT, someone will be doing 3D detailed simulations of large sequences of reversals over hundreds of millions of years, which is what I want to look at here. But luckily for me, they're not doing it this meeting, so I can give a talk here talking about this sort of modeling, but not in terms of in any way a detailed dynamo simulation. Instead, a rather simplistic toy model simulation. So in order to get these hundreds of million years worth of reversals, we're going to something really simple. So, and at the core of this model, there is a really amazingly simple toy model, which is just this set of three ODEs, where we've sort of thrown away all the spatial dependence and are just looking for reversals of the dipole field in this low-order system. So we've got an ODE for a colloidal field S, colloidal field T, and for some omega effect omega. And in the absence, and we've got a sort of idealized mean field effect going on, so we've got an alpha effect generating a toroidal field and an omega effect generating a toroidal field. And we assume there's some forcing generating our omega effect, and there's coupling due to the Lorentz force of our magnetic field modifying this. So it's just this set of three ODEs. It's in the spirit of a very old model by Ricky Tacky for modeling reversals, which went back to the 50s. And for constant alpha, you know, these S, T, and omega are just going to vary with time. And here, I've not said anything about alpha yet, but if we had constant alpha already for some values of alpha, this would be capable of chaotically reversing chaotic reversals. But the ones that come out of this don't look particularly Earth-like. What we're going to do instead, and sort of inspired by earlier work of Peter Hoing, who pointed out the importance of multiplicative noise in the dynamo system, we're going to have this alpha varying with rather large fluctuations dynamically throughout the model and see the effect of this on the statistics of our reversals. And the effect is quite pronounced. Okay. So this is the sort of low-order model for the large-scale fields. We're coupling it to something just to generate this alpha. I don't want to talk in too much detail about this now. In some sense, we can consider it a technical aspect for this talk. There was a discussion on reversals earlier in the program on the 30th of May, and that's on the web, and there's more discussion about the model here. But the basic idea behind this is just, it's a way to couple our low-order model of the large-scale field to a similar sort of toy model of turbulence. So we're coupling a toy large-scale reversal model to a toy model of turbulence to generate our mean alpha effect, and we're doing it through one of these turbulent shell models. So I'll not explain it in detail now, as I said, but it's basically a more or less off-the-shelf shell model where you look at the fluctuations of velocity over a range of n, which corresponds to shells in k-space, wave number space. And these things can generate many results similar to real turbulence, including Kolmogorov-type scaling. And we're going to sort of just have this running along in the background of our model. It's going to be coupled to a large-scale field, again, just through a Lorentz force-type feedback on the mean driving of this thing. But all we're going to use this for, in terms of our model, is to take the equivalent of the helicity in the shell model and use this in line with the sort of naive idea from simple mean field theory to generate the alpha in our model. So we're going to have this set of coupled shells in the background, integrating away, trying to simulate some sort of turbulent effect, just so that we can get a rather noisy alpha coming out that we can couple to the earlier equations, which gives quite nice looking reversal. So we let this run. Obviously, it's a zero order model spatially, so we can run it for essentially as long as we want. Here I'm just showing quick samples of typical behavior of colloidal field S, colloidal field T is on the right here. Our omega effect is bottom right, and the alpha is bottom left. Apologies for the quality of these plots. I just replaced my normal ones because I realized we've not really shown much of what the alpha in these models looked like. So I couldn't find a nicer set, really, which actually showed the alpha along with the other variables. For each of these things is just the time evolution for a span of these things. The colloidal field S is the top left one, so it's going along in time. Zero's in the middle here, and you can see it has many of these little reversals over a range of length scales. The colloidal field is doing something similar on the right, and it's coupled quite closely, as you can imagine, from the lower order model to the fluctuations in this omega effect variable. Both of these things tend to fluctuate quite regularly together and generate these small-scale fluctuations visible in the colloidal field. And meanwhile, in the background, there's this shell model running to generate this alpha effect. And hopefully you can at least see a little bit from this thing that the statistics of this thing are not really normal. There is a mean non-zero part here, but there's fluctuations all about it, and there's quite extreme intermittent fluctuations in many cases. And, well, perhaps amazing, it's amazing to us, point of this model is that in many respects the fluctuations you get out of it are rather like the ones you get from the observed paleomagnetic record. So if we focus on a short span of the colloidal field coming out of this model, so time is on the bottom again here, colloidal field is on the vertical axis to zero, as you can read it, it's right in the middle here. So we're closing in on a span just with half a dozen or so reversals, which could be compared quite directly to the virtual axial dipole moments that you get from paleomagnetic measurements. And you'll get, well, I'll look at the statistics of the intervals between reversals in a second, but you get a similar spread of those intervals of reversals. And you also get quite a similar nature of fluctuations going on here. And you get a sort of characteristic shape to these, at least in the regime where the reversal inter-event times agree most closely with the measured paleomagnetic ones. You do get a sort of characteristic shape here where there's an abrupt recovery from the reversal and then a more or less slow decline before the next reversal. I should have said right at the start that for comparison with the next plot, I've plotted this with time increasing to the left so that we can compare it to what the paleomagnetists plot when they do a comparable thing. And this is one of their plots where the present day is on the left, and we go back in time to the right to 4 million years in this particular data set. This is from Valley and Minaglia in 1993 Nature paper. And, well, it was analyzed in more detail in an Earth and Planetary Science Nature paper in 1994, where they pointed out for this real virtual axial dipole measurement, the moment rather from the paleomagnetic intensity measurement, that they have these similar sort of sawtooth asymmetric reversals going on in the data here. Okay, a lot of information here. I'll just quickly talk through it and then show some plots that hopefully highlight more clearly what's actually happening here. We wanted to compare our reversals to the paleomagnetic reversals. We do so by taking one of the sets in the literature of paleomagnetic inter-reversal duration times. We've done it in this particular talk for the set from Gradstein and Og, 1996. But we've done a similar comparison for Candy and Kent, 1995. The conclusions are the same. We compare the set of inter-reversal times from this to a set of standard probability distribution functions using a variety of statistical tests. Anderson, Darling, Tomogos, Smirnov, and chi-squared all confirm that the inter-reversal durations in the real data are best fit by a log-normal or a log-logistic distribution. The key point is that the real set of paleomagnetic reversals, including the superchrons, this wide range of observed chrons, requires a heavy-tailed distribution to get this spread of range of events to explain it well. I'll show the plots in a second. The key point for the sake of our model is that our synthetic model, our simple model that I described in the first couple of overheads, also gives a set of inter-reversal times well explained by these types of distributions. And in terms of the statistics of the fit, the fact that these come from these distributions would not be rejected at any of the standard levels of significance you might look at. And we have looked at some of the other low-order dynamo models in the literature. So there's one by Ian Melbourne and Alistair Rutledge and people, the original Rikitake one. There's one by Clement Nathau and collaborators, including Marie Lumel. And ours seem to give the reversals most comparable to the observed paleomagnetic one. So if I just sort of illustrate this by showing what's essentially just a cumulative distribution function for our chrons, this is the real data, this is the Gravstein log set of reversals going back 167 million years or so, including the Cretaceous superchron. The event duration between reversals in millions of years is shown in the horizontal axis. The vertical axis is just percent in the cumulative plot, but in a scale that's mapped so that the best fit log normal, in this case distribution, appears as a straight line with brackets in the 95% intervals. And throughout essentially the whole range of this thing, with the possible exception of the superchron, this is quite well fit by the log normal distribution. The superchron, again, I don't want to say anything about here, but again, in this discussion, it was on the KITP website, if you care to look, I said a bit more about how this model can explain the superchrons here. Okay, this is exactly the same plot, but now for our set of our synthetic reversals. Again, we're getting reversals in our simple model over a range, over four orders of five orders of magnitude differing inter-reversal period, which is far from trivial in this sort of model. And again, they're being well fit by log normal or similar heavy tail distributions. And I should say, very poorly fit across this whole range of reversal periods by, say, exponential distribution or a gamma distribution. Okay, we've got this low order model. We'd like to, we think it does at least do something quite well in terms of modeling reversals of the Earth. But we'd like to try and look at it in a bit more detail. Ideally, if we think it is, in any sense, a reasonable model, we'd like to get diagnostic behavior in our low-order model that we can then compare to the real paleomagnetic measurements. And there's a lot we can do. So obviously, in terms of a basic low-order model, if we just assume alpha was constant for the moment, this is trivially easy to analyze this thing and find its fixed points, its theoretical fixed points. There's one at the origin in terms of the magnetic field, and there's a positive magnetic field, negative magnetic field fixed states. And if alpha was constant, you could vary alpha, increase it from zero, and find that for various values of alpha, the origin or the magnetic states are locally stable in a node sense or in a spiral sense. But you'll find that in any event, beyond a certain value, in practice, this thing's globally unstable to the chaotic attractor, which is giving us all these irregular reversals, which is what we're looking for. But of course, in our real model, alpha is fluctuating all the time, and it's taking us, we believe, into and out of various modes of this behavior. So it spends a lot of time in this chaotic attractor, and some of the reversals are just the dynamics of this thing being tracked in phase space. But there's all these fluctuations in alpha, and occasionally it goes down and behaves in a simpler form and essentially is going down towards the origin as if it was a stable node. And the net effect of all this is that the reversals we see are quite intermittently chaotic. And we can sort of argue this quite clearly in our simple model. If we then try and relate this to the real Earth, we can sort of give ourselves a more or less plausible story, and that's all this thing is here. It's just a cartoon diagram trying to explain, see if this sort of analysis on the previous slide can help us explain some of the reversals over the last 4 million years. Again, this is the data from Valle and Minardi, 1993. And if you're willing to believe it, you can see some of these as labeled type 1. Leukosensky, like steady decay, with the oscillations driven by the coupled omega and T on top of them. Others look more like asymmetry decays. It's easy to do this thing, and it's very hard to justify it rigorously. So, notwithstanding the fact that we hope our model's doing something similar here, we realize fairly soon that we need something more quantitative to look at the paleomagnetic data for a real comparison. So we looked in books of nonlinear time series analysis and try to find techniques which could identify the signature of the fluctuations in the real paleomagnetic measurements using these techniques. And we're going to apply this to a slightly more recent data, the SYNC 2000 paleointensity data from the Valle and Minardi and Theodore 2005, because it's got 2000 measurements equispaced in time every kilo years going back 2,000 years from sedimentary paleointensity, from sedimentary cores. And we can take this data, I've called it here just SI, you know, there's these 2,000 data points, and see what we can see from this data in terms of what's going on, you know, and the possible dynamics behind it. And one of the first things you can try is to construct a delay vector, construct some m-dimensional vector using these points with a given delay, which you can interpret from the data using various techniques. Okay, there's not going to be time in this meeting to discuss, in this talk, to discuss the methods used in this thing. They're all discussed in this paper in Neurophysics Letters, which is just available online. The key, you know, just to name check the methods and say what they suggest, it suggests that you can get the maximum information out of this SYNC 2000 data by looking at it with a delay of 13 kiloyears between measurements. And using the method of false nearest neighbors suggests that if you just consider a vector with a number of points like this in the range 5 to 7, the vast majority of the fluctuations in this data are explained by that low-dimensional system there. And just to then use some of the tests on this thing, you can use your M, your 5 or your 7 space delay vectors here, and use some tests to determine the nature of the fluctuations in this data. And one particular test of Kaplan and Glass, which is designed to distinguish determinism from stochasticity in such time series, gives a number lambda equals to 0.7 on a test where lambda equals 1 corresponds to perfectly deterministic data and 0 corresponds to stochastic data. Various algorithms give us Lyapunov exponents for this data of order 11 per mega years, suggesting that the time, the refolding time for separation of these trajectories in the real data is of order 100,000 years, so that predictability on order 1,000 years may still be possible. And there's another technique for scale-dependent Lyapunov exponents where you look at this as a function of the separation of points or of trajectories in your n-dimensional space. Suggests that this is consistent with the idea of intermittent chaos and this thing fluctuating in and out of a chaotic regime. Although, I guess I'd be the first to acknowledge that in this data with just these 2,000 intensity measurements, there's probably not enough points there to say this definitively at this point. If that set can be extended back in the past, obviously things would be much improved. If I can just close by showing a couple of phase portraits of these things for the SYNC 2000 data, and then for our model, we'd argue at least that there's something visible in the SYNC 2000 data which is comparable to the lower order dynamics of our model. So here we're just plotting a data point from SYNC 2000 versus another point separated by this optimum delay. And there's a bunch of points up here corresponding to more or less stable positive dipoles, a bunch corresponding to more or less stable negative dipoles, and there's sadly not enough points in between where there's reversals. In this data there's only 5 reversals, and yet the sort of characteristic spiral nature which you can try and see in this curve is rather reminiscent of the stuff we can see in our own lower-order model, where obviously we've got loads of, you know, we can generate as many points as we want, again get more or less positive and negative stable states, and have some idea of the, well, just the projection of phase space of the paths of these things through the reversals. This is it for one of our models where we've used this turbulent shell model to produce a couple intermittent alpha. Perhaps you see a clear picture of the basic attractor shape of the low order model itself. If you look at a slightly different thing, where rather than using the real messy alpha, which helps us reproduce the reversal spread as well as possible, we look at it where it's a much simpler form of alpha, which is just a constant component plus random noise, and the structure of this attractor then becomes a lot clearer. And well, obviously it's very difficult to say that from the data there is, the structure is very clear, but it's at least quite suggestive that a similar type of rehearsal behavior is going on. I better stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. questions?
Five to seven is quite high for an embedding dimension. I know you said it was quite a low dimensional. So does that, would that seem to imply that maybe if you take your low order model and just keep four of your shells, you ought to be able to get the correct results?
Maybe, I mean, I certainly agree that in terms of our shell model, the fact that we've got these 19 shells with complex coefficients is quite wasteful. You know, all the times in our integration are not dealing with the actual lower model, it's dealing with the shell model. And we sort of did it originally because it seemed like a nice idea. And then as soon as we realized that, you know, there might be simpler ways to do it, we tried just replacing the alpha with something from a particular distribution stochastically generated. But we never found anything that way which reproduced the, you know, the inter-reversal event times as convincingly as the original. So we've stuck with it so far for that reason.
So how did you choose the parameters for your shell model?
There's not that, I mean, a little bit of trial and error in terms of getting alpha in the right range to get sort of a reasonable spread of reversals going on. In terms of the number of shells and the viscosity, that's just very, very standard.
Yeah, so there was a non-linear coupling.
There was a non-linear coupling, which was just the simplest form we could think of for our Lorentz force interaction.
Yes. Graeme, just a quick question. What is the value of tau you took there in this diagram?
In this diagram, it's 13 points in the SYNC 2000 data, so 13,000 years.
13,000 years.
So your model in the current state exhibits the stochastic behavior, but can it be modified so that it exhibits some steady dynamo or regular reversals? Did you look into that?
There's certainly regimes where the lower the model is steady. I mean, they're obviously not very interesting. I mean, obviously, because we've gone to a lower the model, we've lost all spatial form of reversals, interaction of dipole and quadrupole modes and so on. So, you know, we've not been looking in much detail in the simpler states. What we've been trying to use it for is just to look at the varying timescales of reversals. And well, the reason we've stuck with it as long as we have is just that there seems to be some interesting stuff there. When we first proposed doing it, we just thought we'd see how bad a 0D model goes in space before going back to a 1D or 2D to try and get more Earth-like reversals happening. But the stuff, you know, the reversals we've been getting out of this model have looked sufficiently intriguing that we've, you know, we're still looking at them now.
I've just got one quick question. It's often argued that the very long supercrons are evidence that there's mantle convection timescales involved in this process.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying that you think you can reproduce the actual statistics of reversals in a natural way without tuning parameters by these types of models?
We're saying that at least over the timescales of 160 million years, the paleomagnetic data, at least using the tests we've looked at so far, is not inconsistent with the idea that there's a single stationary underlying type of geodynamo action, notwithstanding the fact that, of course, mantle control should happen, certainly on longer timescales anyway. We're saying it doesn't seem to be necessary a priori. And we do find that in our model, over a comparable spread of reversals, we can get this extreme range of cron lengths, which initially we thought would be very difficult to find.
Right, yes, I understand.
So just a follow-up question on the same subject. You didn't show the supercron results here, but is there a strong correlation between the average field strength and the cron length that would appear with the supercron in your analysis?
So, yeah, I mean, if we look at our data, if we look at the peak intensity of a cron versus the cron duration, within our model, there's a pretty well-defined relation. This is the best form, the best relatively simple form we've found to characterize it. It's pretty well constrained in terms of the regression of our model data, where we can obviously generate as much of this as we want. I mean, of course, similar things have been suggested for the real data, unfortunately, from the Raleigh Minardi data is many fewer orders of magnitude. You know, over 4 million years, there's not much spread of peak intensities or cron durations, but we're not the first to suggest it, but the model form that works for our lower-order model works just as well for those reversals, no matter how few there are. You know, obviously it's not very tightly constrained.
Regarding the coupling of your shell model to the mean field model, Steve asked a question regarding free parameters. It occurred to me that the length scale of the outer scale of the shell model may be a parameter that you may need to adjust either correctly or you may treat it as a free parameter. One would naively think that the outer length scale of the shell model should be half of the length scale that intrinsically is present in the mean field model. And so you would have no longer freedom as regards to the turbulent diffusion time, for example.
It's quite difficult to say that there's a particular length in the mean field model because there's really no spatial form left in the mean field model. Sorry? In the shell model, yes, but not in the large scale model. Sorry?
So it's a 1 over tau, and the tau comes out of the shell model, I think. Intrinsically, okay. I mean, self-consistently.
So you're saying that, I mean, here we've just imposed an inverse diffusion time.
Yes.
We haven't tried to correlate that.
So have you chosen kappa yourself, or?
Yeah, we've chosen it, say, to correspond to, you know, if we wanted our units to be in years, we've chosen.
I see. But I think it should come out of the shell model, this kappa.
Well, if there's a good consistent way to do it, then we'll obviously try it, yeah.